Good evening, and thank you for coming out. I'm Ken Sullivan with the West Virginia Humanities Council, and on behalf of the Humanities Council and Harvard Club of West Virginia, I'm pleased to welcome you to this evening's lecture by Harvard Professor Timothy McCarthy. Professor McCarthy has spoken in Charleston at least once before, and we're delighted to have him back with us again. Our partnership with the Harvard Club makes it possible to bring top-notch scholars to town on very favorable terms, and we appreciate the opportunity to collaborate, gentlemen. Thank you so much. Our thanks to the Harvard Club, especially to Dr. Dan Foster, who was instrumental in arranging this evening's program. We also thank Bailey and Glasser for their financial sponsorship. We appreciate that so much, gentlemen. Thank you for coming out, and thank you for your sponsorship. Special thank you to the Woman's Club of Charleston. This is the first time that we've had a program here, and we appreciate their enthusiastic support and civic-mindedness in sharing this beautiful space with us. Thank you, ladies. Thank you. A reminder that we will have refreshments following the talk. Please plan to join us. There's no reason to rush out of here this evening, so plan to stay after the lecture. Looking forward to future programs, filmmaker Susan Shoemaker will speak at the historic McFarland Hubbard House on Sunday, May 31. Susan is a producer with Ken Burns's Florentine Films, now working on his upcoming documentary on country music. She'll offer insider views on the Burns award-winning media operation and also insights on managing a job of national scope from her home in Morgantown. Call 346-8500 to reserve your seat for that lure. Dan Foster will introduce this evening's speaker. Dan himself is the proverbial man who needs no introduction, and that's just what I'm going to give him. Welcome, Dr. Dan Foster.
Thank you so much, Ken. What a great crowd. We appreciate the response from Charleston to come out for this, what we hope will be, and I'm sure will be, an enjoyable evening. And I certainly want to thank Ken and Mark Payne for their hard work in making this happen. I happen to be fortunate to be on both the boards of the West Virginia Humanities Council and the Harvard Club of West Virginia, so I feel doubly proud to see this type of response from this community. And with that collaboration, over at least the last decade, we've been able to bring distinguished speakers to this community, including tonight's speaker, who actually was here several years ago. Again, Ken and Mark are extraordinary individuals in this community, and I think they deserve a round of applause for all they do. I would also be remiss if I didn't mention the generous sponsorship of the Bailey and Glasser Law Firm, particularly Ben Bailey and Brian Glasser, and our club officer, Ryan Donovan, who's here this evening from Bailey and Glasser. As Ken mentioned, I have the wonderful privilege of introducing tonight's speaker. And so if you just bear with me for just a couple of minutes, there's more than a little to say. Timothy Patrick McCarthy is an award-winning scholar, teacher, an activist. He holds a joint faculty appointment in Harvard's undergraduate honors program in history and literature and at Harvard's Kennedy School. He is also the Stanley Patterson Professor of American History in the Boston Clemente course in the humanities in Dorchester, Massachusetts. A native of upstate New York, he spent the last quarter century really in the Boston area, and where he has also seen the other gold dome capital in this country. Graduated with honors in history and literature from Harvard College and earned his MA, Master's of Philosophy, and PhD in history from Columbia, and later served for 5 years as a research fellow at Columbia's Institute for Research in African American Studies. An historian of politics and social movements, Professor McCarthy's work focuses on slavery and abolition, media culture, and communications, literature of protests, and the American radical tradition. He also enjoys politics of race, gender, and sexuality in the United States, and global human rights. He is the author and editor of 5 books, including Prophets of Protest, Reconsidering the History of American Abolitionism. Is a frequent media commentator on such outlets as NPR, BBC, and Bloomberg Radio, and has published essays widely, including The Daily Beast and in the Boston Globe. His undergraduate courses, including Stories of Slavery and Freedom and Arts of Communication, are consistently among the most popular and highly rated at Harvard, and he has received some of the most prestigious teaching awards at the college and the Kennedy School. In addition to his research, writing, and teaching, he has devoted his life to public service and social justice. As founding director of Harvard's Alternative Spring Break Church Rebuilding Program, he has spent 15 years organizing groups of undergraduates to help rebuild African American churches that were destroyed in arson attacks. As if he has extra time, in collaboration with the American Repertory Theater's National Civil War Project, McCarthy is currently writing his first play, Four Harriets, about the intersecting lives of 4 abolitionist women, Harriet Beecher Stowe, Harriet Wilson, Harriet Jacobs, and Harriet Tubman. He acknowledged to me on the way down here that 2 of his proudest accomplishments are, first, he played on the Harvard basketball team, and just last year, he was the escort at commencement for Aretha Franklin. As he calls her, Dr. Franklin, who received an honorary degree. As you can see, we're indeed fortunate to have Dr. McCarthy with us again this evening. The depth and breadth of his experience is indeed unique, and I'm certain that all of us in attendance will be rewarded for making the decision to be here. So please join me in welcoming Professor McCarthy back to wild, wonderful West Virginia to tell us about the changing role of media and politics from Tom Paine to Twitter.
Thank you so much, Dan. Thanks, everybody. Ken, Dan, everyone from the Harvard Club of West Virginia and the West Virginia Humanities Council and the Women's Club of Charleston and all of you fine folks who have come here tonight. As you said, this is my second time coming back here in the capacity of having been invited by the Harvard Club and the Humanities Council, but it's actually not only my second time to Charleston. One of the church rebuilding trips that I took many years ago was to Charleston, West Virginia, a church that had been burned in this community. And the first time I came here was actually to go to the, near here, Harper's Ferry in West Virginia, was to go to the bicentennial conference of John Brown's birth at Harper's Ferry, which was quite a time, I will say. I wanted to start, just thank you all again for coming, and I'm going to sketch out a bunch of different kinds of things tonight, and then I want to open it up towards the end of the time we have for a conversation, because this is a topic that always seems to inspire lots of commentary and lots of questions and lots of opinions. But I wanted to start, actually, by reading something from my phone. But before I do that, I'm talking about media culture, so I'm going to start on my smartphone. But before I do that, I want to say that something happened to me on the way here today that ultimately is tempering the argument that I can make. So one of the arguments I'm going to make tonight is that our media culture has changed, and it's profoundly influencing the way we do politics, and the fact that it's changed dramatically in recent years, and it's much of what we do today is not like what we did 5 or 10 or 20 years ago. And so there's a certain bias that I have as a middle-aged person who spends most of my time around young people who are always on their machines all the time, glued to their screens, that I was supposed to do a radio interview today, speaking of media and politics in advance of this lecture. Some of you may have heard it. My flight was delayed and my bag had to be checked, and I put my my charger in my checked bag. And so my iPhone 6, which is very fancy, I can do all sorts of things on this phone, was running out of juice. And so the radio host was going to call me on my phone, and I didn't have any more juice. I didn't have a charger. And Dan loaned me his phone, which is a flip phone, which I haven't seen in a long time. And it not only had juice in it, but it had a local number, and the radio host was able to call me on Dan's phone in the car on my way to the hotel, and I did the radio interview, and my iPhone was completely friggin' useless. So I want to begin there because it has something to do with our topic tonight. But the other thing I want to do is I want to read something from my Facebook wall to all of you that will help us begin this conversation tonight. And this is something that I posted yesterday, if I can find it. It was a very funny thing that was posted by a friend of mine. And as you may have heard from the news yesterday, yesterday was a historic day in terms of politics and media culture, that the President of the United States, Barack Obama, opened up his own Twitter account. And he has his own Twitter handle, at POTUS, President of the United States. And he says, President Obama says, at POTUS, "Hello, Twitter, it's Barack. Really? 6 years and they're finally giving me my own account." Within several minutes, there were millions of followers, including at Bill Clinton, who wrote, "Welcome to at Twitter, at POTUS. One question, does that username stay with the office? Hashtag asking for a friend." And that was retweeted and liked many, many times. And then at POTUS responds saying, "Good question, at Bill Clinton. This handle comes with the house. Know anyone interested in at FLOTUS?" So I'm going to make some claims in this speech, some of which are a little bit provocative, some of which are grounded in evidence. But one claim that I know is true is that Tom Paine and the Founding Fathers could never have imagined that moment yesterday. That there is no way that we talk a lot about what the Founding Fathers thought and what the Founding Fathers said and what the Founding Fathers meant. There is no way that in any of those discussions or debates that we have all the time in this country, we would have ever conjured up something like Twitter, where the first black president was talking to the former president from Arkansas about his wife becoming the next president and perhaps the first female president. Needless to say, Tom Paine's head might not have exploded, but Thomas Jefferson and George Washington's probably would have. So my topic tonight is the changing role of media in politics from Tom Paine to Twitter. And I just want to start out by saying, as Dan mentioned in the bio, that I'm a historian who teaches courses on social movements and politics. I'm a historian who teaches courses on media and communications and leadership, particularly in the United States. In addition, I've worked on political campaigns at the local, state, and national level, including the 2008 presidential campaign, the Obama campaign. I also blog and I tweet. As of this afternoon, I had something like 4,000 Facebook friends, so that's probably going up because I just officiated a wedding and the HAA has been tweeting about this thing, so I'll probably have a couple more later on. So I'm keenly interested in this topic, both as a practitioner and a scholar and as a witness and citizen. That I'm really interested in the historical dimensions of this topic as a historian and scholar, but I'm also interested in the contemporary cultural and political dimensions of this topic. So I'd like to approach my remarks tonight from these two vantage points, to sketch out the relationship between media and politics over time, historically in the United States, and also to think about how it impacts all of us, whether we think it does or not, as global citizens in a 21st century world. And I want to start with three fairly simple propositions. The first, and this should be obvious, is that the relationship between media and politics has changed dramatically over time. That's not a particularly controversial claim. Things are different now than they were in the American Revolution. That's my basic proposition. I think we can probably all agree on that, and I'll be exploring some of that tonight. Second, however, is another proposition, which is that I'd like to suggest that media culture itself has been, always has been, and continues to be a place of conflict and contest that requires us to broaden our definition of what we consider to be politics. And so tonight, when I refer to politics, I'm not just referring to national politics, presidential campaigns and the like, although I will talk about those along the way, but to also the everyday experiences and expressions and struggles of ordinary people to participate in their democracy. And third, I want to argue that we are in a profound moment of transformation with respect to how we use media and engage and shape our politics and vice versa. That this is the tricky thing for me. As a historian, you don't tend to try to make sense of the present until it is past. You try to say, okay, give it a generation, and then we'll try to figure it out once we have some remove from it. But this is a moment where historians and everybody else are swept up in these cultural and political tides of change. And so we have to sort of figure it out as we go along. And that's a problem and a challenge for us. But I want to say that I'm not someone, and maybe it's because I turned 44 in 2 weeks. I'm Gen X, I'm middle-aged, I'm between this millennial generation and the baby boomer generation. And I don't see social media and what's happening in our culture, even though I talk a little bit of smack about my students always being on screens. I'm on my screen a lot more than I'd like to as well. I'm not one of these people who thinks that social media and all of the things that are taking place right now in terms of the media culture that we're a part of is all bad. But I also don't think it's all good. A lot of my students think that because it's new, it's good. And a lot of my elders think because it's new, it's bad. And I'm not one of those people who goes into either of those camps. I actually take something of a middle ground on this issue to acknowledge that social media and new media and our new political culture is not a promised land or a bargain with the devil, but rather to acknowledge how much is changing, how rapidly it's changing, but also to acknowledge that these changes contain certain challenges for us as democratic citizens, but they also represent new possibilities for democratic engagement, and I want to talk about that tonight. But first, let's talk a little bit about history. This nation was born politically of media culture. It was born of print and protest. In particular, the colonists used print culture, pamphlets principally, but also newspapers and broadsides and a whole range of printed materials, to debate, often quite vigorously, a whole range of issues. Everything from taxation and representation to independence and self-governance, rights and revolution, slavery and the constraints of citizenship. And they did this principally, certainly in oral culture and face-to-face debates, but they did it principally in pamphlets and newspapers and broadsides throughout the period between the 1760s and the 1780s. And an enormous amount of political change occurred during that period as a result of these printed political debates. Take, for instance, in 1760, when King George III ascended to the throne in Britain, none of the 13 colonies protested that ascension. 1760, not nary a peep, really, from the colonies about the ascension of King George III to the throne. By the time the Declaration of Independence was drafted and ratified and put into circulation, King George III was the representation of the devil incarnate in the world as we knew it. So something had happened between 1760 and 1776, and some of those things are documented in the pamphlets and print culture and the printed debates that were taking place in that media culture of the time. And as an undergraduate, I was one of the students in Bernard Bailyn's last class at Harvard on the American Revolution. And Bernard Bailyn, of course, is the Bancroft and Pulitzer Prize-winning historian of the book Ideological Origins of the American Revolution, where he kind of maps out how all of these political debates were taking place in all of these printed materials. And I remember that course being kind of a life-changing course for me because I was starting to realize that the printed pamphlets and broadsides and newspapers of the American Revolution were the CNNs and the MTVs of their day. In 1760, as I said, not one of the 13 colonies protested the ascension of King George III to the throne. In 1765, 5 years later, two of the most prominent pamphleteers of the American Revolution were deeply pessimistic about the prospects for independence. James Otis from Massachusetts, Harvard educated, first to write a pamphlet denouncing the Stamp Act, said this: "Were the colonies left to themselves tomorrow, America would be a mere shambles of blood and confusion." Hardly an optimistic rendering. John Dickinson, a lawyer from Philadelphia, who wrote Letters from a Farmer in Pennsylvania, which was a leading pamphlet prior to Tom Paine's Common Sense in 1776, he said that independence would bring a multitude of commonwealths, crimes, and calamities, centuries of mutual jealousies, hatred, and destruction. Also not particularly optimistic, although perhaps prophetic. 1776 was a banner year for political protest and printed debates in this media culture of the time. The public opinion was beginning to shift towards independence, and one of the pamphlets of the revolution, Tom Paine's Common Sense, which was published in January of 1776, written in very simple language and meant to appeal to the common sensibilities of the body politic, wrote and published that pamphlet in January of 1776. And if you had taken, although we don't have this evidence, but from what we can glean, if you had taken something like an opinion poll, a Gallup poll in January of 1776 when Tom Paine, Common Sense was published, there would have been overwhelming support not to declare independence. And through the circulation of that pamphlet and the debates that it unleashed in colonial America and the impulse to independence that started to unfold over the course of that winter and spring, you had, by July of 1776, all 13 states, colonies, now states, unanimously declaring independence from Britain. In that period, while that pamphlet war was going on, in the light and wake of John Paine's publication of Common Sense, during that six-month period, you had 90 mini-declarations, separate declarations of independence, that were passed and published and circulated all throughout the colonies. So as Common Sense set in motion the sort of debate over independence at the local and colonial state level, we might call it state level, there were all of these mini debates that were going on in print that led to printed declarations of independence that ultimately predate the Declaration of Independence, which comes out, of course, that summer. Of course, in 1787 and 1788, you have the Federalist Papers, which is a series of 85 newspaper articles urging the ratification of the new Constitution, published in two different newspapers. Even after the Declaration of Independence was signed, even after the Revolution was virtually over, there were all sorts of debates, constitutional debates, about the new governing documents, how the country would be set up. Because ultimately, the Declaration of Independence was an act of dissent. It was an act of printed civil disobedience. It was a separation of power from one entity to another. The Constitution was a document of consent, laying out the laws and the structures and the institutions by which this new nation, called into being by the Declaration of Independence, would be governed. And there were debates, fierce debates, over that. And so the point I'm trying to make here is that these debates that took place in print, often spoken aloud by those who were literate to those who were not, that these debates in print were fostered the new political language and ultimately gave rise to the new political documents and political institutions of this nation. And that without that printed media culture, you don't get America. You don't get the Declaration of Independence. You don't get the Constitution. That these debates, often vociferous, often vigorous, often vitriolic, were taking place in public through the media culture of the time. And I want to make a final point about the revolution before I move on, is that this debate that was taking place within that printed media culture of the time about the great political ideas and ideals of this era took place without any major technological advance in printing technology. That until the 1790s and early 19th century, printers were using the same kinds of wooden flatbed hand presses that first emerged in 15th century Germany to print the Gutenberg Bibles. That there hadn't been yet a technological revolution in the way that printing presses worked, and yet there was a revolution, a political revolution, of ideas and institutions and individuals that came together in the late 18th century to produce the nation that we now live in. The importance of print continued to be a major factor in the political culture of the United States during the decades leading up to the Civil War. All sorts of reform movements, from women's rights to the common schools movement to temperance, religious movements of various kinds, and of course, the mother of all and the father of all reform and radical movements in the 19th century, the abolitionist movement, used print as a way to disseminate their information, to deepen consciousness around these various reform issues, and to develop something of what I call in my book on abolitionism a counterpolitics. That many of these people were outsiders. These were marginal folks in the political culture. Women could not vote during this period of time, as many people I'm sure know. And so to be denied the right to vote, the voice of the ballot in a political culture, was meant that you were disfranchised from it. Many of the abolitionists, particularly African-American abolitionists and abolitionists who didn't own property, did not have access to the ballot either. And so many of these reformers and radicals, particularly within the struggle for women's rights and particularly within the struggle for abolitionism, were people who needed to develop other mechanisms, other channels to have a political voice, to assert their political will, and to try to induce or to force some kind of political change. And one of the things that these reform movements did, abolitionism was the best example of this, is that they found ways to produce printed materials, both visual images and also printed and literary images, that made it easier, quicker, and cheaper to produce and circulate their ideas. And so what the abolitionists did, like most of the reform movements during this period did, was they created a kind of culture of dissent, a counter-political space that could vie for the other kinds of political spheres that they were outsiders of or that they were excluded from. And the abolitionist movement, again, gives us an example of this. Take, for instance, the fact that the abolitionists were, in 1836, told by Congress that Congress would no longer debate slavery based on anti-slavery petitions that were coming to Congress from ordinary people and citizens. That in 1836, Congress passed a gag rule that said that they would no longer entertain or debate anti-slavery petitions in Congress henceforth, which meant that Congress effectively shut the abolitionists out of having a political voice. So instead, what the abolitionists did, and they had started to do this beforehand, they developed newspapers. They published 60 abolitionist newspapers before the Civil War, 17 of them run, owned, and operated by African Americans. In the mid-1830s, the abolitionists staged a postal campaign where they sought to, instead of sending slave petitions to Congress, they decided to flood the postal ways with abolitionist literature to get people reading and debating issues of slavery. In 1836, the same year the gag rules imposed, was the peak year of the American Anti-Slavery Society's postal campaign. They published more than 1 million printed publications that year. The abolitionist movement, through all of these different local chapters, published over 1 million pieces of printed material that year and flooded the postal ways. So if Congress won't pay attention to us, we'll go into another channel. We'll do it by a different means. Over time, the abolitionist movement began to publish different kinds of protest literature. First, slave narratives, the autobiographies of fugitive slaves and former slaves, which became bestsellers during the 19th century. My colleague Henry Louis Gates Jr. has said that until recent times, black people have never been so easily published in the history of the United States than during this period of the 19th century, from the 1830s to the 1860s, where if you were a fugitive slave and you got hooked up with the abolitionist movement and you had a story to tell, it could find its way to print, oftentimes causing fugitive slaves, people in really precarious situations, to become global celebrities, Frederick Douglass being the most obvious example of that, also Sojourner Truth and many others. And then after the slave narratives became such bestsellers during this period of time, there were also novels that were published, mostly by women, works of domestic and sentimental fiction, that were a way for women to publish their stories, usually fictional stories, but not always. And so these two forms of literary culture, slave autobiographies on the one hand, and domestic works of sentimental fiction authored by women on the other, became the literature of abolitionism. And the literary culture of the United States has its foundation in these texts. That the works of many of the authors that we now consider to be the kind of white male canonical authors of the 19th century had a hard time selling their books. Harriet Beecher Stowe did not have a hard time selling her books, right? Frederick Douglass did not have a hard time selling his autobiography. In fact, he had such an easy time selling his autobiography that he revised it twice more and sold it again. They wanted to hear more of his story as he got older and older and older. So this was a period of time as reformers and radicals were shut out of formal political channels, they developed their own media culture by disseminating through print and visual culture, children's books, broadsides with anti-slavery lyrics, anything you can name. They found ways to influence the politics of the time. And without the abolitionist movement, you don't have the abolition of slavery. Lincoln did not wake up one day in the White House and say, you know what, we've been doing this all wrong. The Emancipation Proclamation was not because he had a good cup of coffee one morning or a cup of tea. The Emancipation Proclamation, the 13th Amendment, the Civil War itself, was partly and fundamentally inspired by the media culture that the abolitionists created and proliferated for the 30 years before the beginning of the Civil War. And if you think about the ways in which that print culture and visual culture became important during the Civil War, think about the state laws that were published in the South and in the Confederacy banning the distribution of abolitionist literature. Many Southern states passed state-level laws to ban the distribution of this literature. During the Civil War itself, Lincoln shut down the postal system and tried to control the circulation of mail so that the South couldn't coordinate with itself militarily. The way that the postal ways and the literary culture and the print culture were controlled, both by the Confederacy and the Union, both by Jefferson Davis and Abraham Lincoln, only suggests how powerful this realm was as a form of media culture influencing politics of the time. During the post-Civil War era, the photograph and visual images through photography emerge alongside print culture as a powerful way to represent social realities and push for political reform. Now, the Civil War was the first American war that was largely photographed. The Crimean War was the first war in history that was photographed. But during the Civil War, photographers on both the Confederate and the Union sides employed photographer and their photography as a way to represent the horrors of the battlefield. The devastation, the deaths, the injuries, the casualties, and oftentimes photography itself became a battleground. Different representations of different sides and different people, the horrors of leaving bodies to die and rot on the field was a form of insult to the other side. And often photography played a role in trying to gin up that kind of support, that nationalism on either side of this great war. Photography also becomes very important in the late 19th century and the early part of the 20th century during the reform movements of that period. Photography became a way for people to photograph and to document, to represent the ills of a society, the ills that came with the rise of industrialization, the rise of cities, the rise of immigration, right? The consolidation of many different kinds of people in smaller and smaller spaces, the tenement houses, the children working in factories, the conditions within which immigrants and other people newly arrived to the country were forced to live. And this photographic evidence gave birth both to an aesthetic of social realism, the realistic representation of what is going on in society, and also to a whole spate of reform laws that were passed, like the food and drug law, child labor laws, ultimately minimum wage laws, housing reform laws, etc., that a whole host of progressive era and New Deal era laws were passed in part because of the role of photography in being able to represent in a visual way, a picture worth a thousand words, in a way that had never been possible before in American society. And part of that had to do with the technological innovation in photography itself. That first, the invention of flashbulb photography, the idea that one could actually could create light inside, right? In darkness, could create light and take an image where you can see what's happening inside. This became particularly important for Jacob Riis in his very famous reform tract, How the Other Half Lives, published in 1890. And he was one of the first journalists, muckraking journalists, to use flashbulb photography to take images to represent alongside his literary descriptions of the horrors of the tenement housing in the Lower East Side of New York. And it was the pairing of that image and that literary description that helped to pass housing and tenement reform laws. And then later on, or around the same time, the 1880s and 1890s, the development of the sort of the handheld camera, the individual camera, so that anybody who wanted to take pictures and had a decent knack for technology could use. It was the smartphone of the time. And Kodak developed the sort of handheld pocket individual camera. This was a way for anybody who wanted to take pictures could start to access that technology as a way of representation, representing the self, representing society, representing what one saw. And so photography during this period of time, through the New Deal, through the 1930s, during the Great Depression, becomes absolutely important. Also, speaking of the New Deal, Franklin Roosevelt seized upon a new technological innovation that had been in existence before he gets elected president in 1932, before the stock market crash of 1829, which brings about the Great Depression and ultimately helps to usher him into the presidency, claiming that there is a new deal, that he's bringing a new deal for America. The invention of the radio in the late 19th and early 20th centuries opened up a new avenue for communication in the political sphere. Radio was first widely used as a form of communication between U.S. and European armies and navies involved in the war efforts during World War I and then subsequently in World War II. But FDR, as a politician, mastered the form of the radio. And the most explicit example of this were his fireside chats, the 30 evening radio addresses from 1933 to 1944. The first one was broadcast on March 2nd of 1933, just after his inauguration. These fireside chats, which are very famous now, and if you mentioned Ken Burns before, the Ken Burns documentary on the Roosevelts, that was just the whole Roosevelt family was just a stunning, stunning documentary set of documentary films. But this is the origin of the weekly radio address. The weekly radio address that presidents have been doing in modern times, that I can't remember them not doing, the origins of the weekly radio address date back to Franklin Roosevelt's fireside chats during the Great Depression and the New Deal. Every president now communicates and has communicated with the nation this way since FDR. President Obama now does audio and video addresses, both on the web and elsewhere, tweets and circulates this through any possible means. And it's also another sign of the evolution of media's use in politics, that this has become something that is, anybody has access to this now, not just someone with a radio. With respect to FDR, the fireside chats he introduced the fireside chats with the very famous opening or salutation, "Good evening, friends." It was a way to decrease the distance between the presidency on the one hand and the people on the other. And that choice of opening each of the fireside chats with "good evening, friends" was a way for Roosevelt to establish a kind of intimacy and proximity to the people during a time of great struggle. It accomplished two things. On the one hand, it allows for the people to feel a closeness to the president. I remember vividly my grandparents, who still had the radio, that they listened to Franklin Roosevelt and the fireside chats on when I was a young kid. They still had that radio, and they would trot it out at every Thanksgiving or Christmas. I don't think it really worked anymore, but they would trot it out because this was the radio that they would listen to Franklin Roosevelt on, and this was shortly after they had come to this country as immigrants themselves. And they told stories as poor people what it was like to listen to the president in their kitchen on that radio every so often. And the other thing that the radio did for Franklin Roosevelt, which was crucial to his presidency, is that it allowed for him to project that famous strong voice to a nation that itself was, in a way, crippled by an economic downturn, and from a man who himself was crippled by polio and had to stand with metal braces, had to be wheeled around in a wheelchair, that the radio, not the photograph, interestingly, and the White House press corps at the time, the photographers who covered politics, had a kind of deal with the White House that they would not photograph Franklin Roosevelt in any kind of physically vulnerable way. They wouldn't photograph him with the metal crutches. They would not photograph him in the wheelchair. They would photograph him from the waist up when he was standing at podiums. If you notice the pictures of Franklin Roosevelt giving speeches, they always cut off right about here, because he often was standing with the metal braces below. But the radio projected an image of Roosevelt as strong, as stronger than anyone in the nation. And his wife, Eleanor Roosevelt, who was very tall and very strong and very powerful, the photographs of her as this strong, tall, powerful woman, and the radio projections of his voice combined in those two types of media to project a confidence in their partnership in the White House at that very, very difficult time. It's notable to mention that in the week after Roosevelt's first fireside chat, 450,000 letters flooded the White House. 450,000 people wrote to the White House after that first fireside chat. FDR had to hire, as a result, when he came into office, there was one mailroom clerk to deal with all the mail in the White House. After his first fireside chat and that first week of mail, he had to hire 70 people to work in the White House mailroom to deal with all of the letters that were coming in. And one of my friends and professors quipped recently that this was the first jobs program of the New Deal. In the post-war period after World War II, the advent of television again changes politics profoundly, particularly the proliferation of TV for both broadcast and advertising purposes in the post-war period, and the marketing of TVs themselves as a marker of a kind of middle-class suburban existence, that everybody wanted a TV and needed to have a TV, not only for entertainment's sake, but also for marketing purposes and for political purposes. The first presidential TV talk aired in 1947. President Eisenhower had his first televised news conference in 1955. John F. Kennedy becomes a star on television, ready-made for television, with his youthful good looks and energy, his beautiful family, his adorable children. Dan told me on the way over here that the first televised presidential debate was not actually the Nixon-John F. Kennedy debate, but was the Democratic primary, which was here in Charleston, where John F. Kennedy was debating Hubert Humphrey, right? And that was the first televised presidential debate. So I had to revise my script here. If I'm wrong about that, it's Dan who's wrong, not me. But JFK became a star. We all know the sort of famous story or the myth of the televised debate between Nixon and John F. Kennedy, where he looks so much younger, so much more vital, so much more ready to govern than Richard Nixon did. And of course, he wins in a squeaker election in 1960. I don't want to make the point here that without television, you wouldn't have JFK. Obviously, JFK was bigger than TV, and TV was bigger than JFK. That there's not a direct causal relationship that you have radio, so therefore Franklin Roosevelt, or you have Franklin Roosevelt and therefore radio. Obviously, history is far more complicated than that. But to argue against the role of television, the prominent role of television, transforming the way that we understand politics, how politics was performed, the way that protest was made visible all across the country, that television in the 1960s becomes a profoundly political medium, not only in the role that it played early on in helping JFK get elected, but in the role that it played in helping parts of the country that didn't know as much about what was going on with respect to racism and civil rights in the South, that the televised beatings of children and of nonviolent civil disobedient peace protesters, civil rights protesters, the Children's March in Birmingham in the spring of 1963. I remember family members of mine in New York talking about seeing those images on television and their desire to do something to assist this cause, or their horror that this was happening in the country. The way that those images of the civil rights movement in the South and then later in the North and the urban uprisings and riots that happened in the wake of Martin Luther King's assassination, all of that was televised. The war in Vietnam, the escalation of the war in Vietnam was televised. There's a famous anecdote of Walter Cronkite, who went to Vietnam in late 1967 and 1968, came back. We went to made a trip to Vietnam in February of 1968 and came back, and his coverage of what was happening in the war shifted. And LBJ famously said to one of his aides, "I've lost Cronkite, so I've lost Middle America." And shortly thereafter, he said he was not running for re-election. Obviously, again, not a A to B causal relationship, but the role that Walter Cronkite played as the person who was giving everyone in America who had a television the news at the same time, in the same way, every single night, was critical to the way that we as a nation understood politics in the 1960s, and yet it was also a place where the divisions and the political divisiveness and the violence of the war and the violence of the civil rights movement were played out in real time before everybody's eyes who was turned on those television sets. So at the time that you're getting a kind of uniform, there's a uniformity to the way that the nightly news was packaged and delivered. There was also, or there were also within that newscast, images of things that deeply divided the nation. And so at the same time that you have one channel giving you all the news you need to know, you're also, through this medium, getting the news that ultimately divides the nation along lines of war and peace, black and white, north and south, etc. And so television becomes this powerful medium, both for politics and for protests during the 1960s. And that only continues into the modern period. When I first started thinking about this lecture, and when I first started, I'm actually thinking about maybe writing a book, a sort of panoramic book on this subject at some point once I have some free time. But one of the things that struck me is that the advent of CNN, CNN emerges in 1980 when Ronald Reagan is elected president of the United States. MTV is founded less than a year later, 1981. Fox News and MSNBC, both of them, come into existence in 1996, right as Bill Clinton is in the midst of a re-election campaign and right before the revelation of the Monica Lewinsky, what becomes the Monica Lewinsky scandal, which both Fox News and MSNBC, certainly Fox News, used to great effect in terms of ratings, in terms of money, in terms of popularity, in terms of presence on the political scene. And I don't think it's a coincidence, really, that you have Ronald Reagan, a former movie actor, whose political career begins at precisely the moment we have 24-hour news. CNN and Ronald Reagan start at the same time. MTV starts a year later. And it's no coincidence that the sort of partisan politics of our media culture and our Democratic and Republican parties that we saw start to become almost violent during the 1990s, and then increasingly divisive, increasingly partisan over the course of the 2000s down to our own age, come at precisely the moment that Fox and MSNBC emerge simultaneously in the media culture to take that 24-hour cable news network to kind of on steroids. And so that is the sort of world that we are now living in, a world where we don't get our news every night from the same source. We don't get our news every day from the same source. There is no one trusted name in news. There's no one place where all the news is fit to print. Often, I would argue right now that all of us have gotten lots of news today, and there probably aren't two people in this room who've gotten all their news from the same news source just today. We don't have time to do a poll, but I would guess that even if you've both read the same paper or watched the same television show, that one of you snuck away to get on Facebook. Maybe your grandson or your daughter have told you what they posted on Twitter. Maybe you've heard someone talking about it in the market or at the coffee shop. But we no longer live in an age where there is one person giving us the news. We no longer live in an age where only news makers, media people, make the news. Increasingly in a social media world, social media is what leads the videos that we take on our smartphones, the tweets that are going back and forth between a former president and a current president about a perhaps future president, the things that people post on Facebook, the videos of a cop shooting an unarmed black man, 10,000 people walking into a square in a country with an authoritarian regime in the Middle East. The way that we do news and make news and circulate news and receive news and think about it has completely changed. We're all newsmakers now. We're all media cultural producers now. And we're all citizens now in a way that is very different. Let me just give you a couple of examples of recent things that I think are really changing the way that we do things and the way that we engage. One is that social media has made national borders and national boundaries less significant. that one of the things that we see in the use of social media is there's a certain democratizing influence that it has had, that everybody can do it. Every single person in here with a phone or access to a computer can post on Facebook, can tweet something out, can do something on Instagram. If you have a smartphone, you can do all of it at once. You can literally take a picture, record a video, and post it on 5 different things, and it's out there and it's already circulating. And if you're lucky and you happen to be in the right place at the right time, you might actually influence the news. A couple of weeks ago, I actually watched I watched CNN, MSNBC, and Fox News from 6 o'clock to 10 o'clock, flipping back and forth. Don't try this at home. It's not fun. It was actually a very painful experience, and you realize how much of it's repetitive. But the other thing that I realized, aside from the fact that what you're getting is news on Fox News and what you're getting on news on MSNBC bear no relationship to each other unless they're talking shit about each other. The only time there's anything in common is when Bill O'Reilly talks smack about Rachel Maddow or Rachel Maddow talks smack about Bill O'Reilly. Otherwise, there's very little in common. You could actually think that you're living in two different countries. And so it's actually dangerous, I would argue, regardless of where your politics lie, to only get your source from one source. But one of the things I noticed was that so much of what was being reported had its origin in some kind of social media something. So a scandal that was broken on Twitter, a comment that someone made that was picked up on YouTube, right? A picture that somebody sent to an intern that they weren't supposed to send it to on whatever. That these are a text, a sext. These kinds of things that are taking place now and taking place all the time on social media were actually leading the news. They talk about if it bleeds, it leads. I think if it leaks, it leads. We're now at a point where social media is starting to actually influence what gets reported. And that is not, I'm not saying that that's necessarily good or bad, but it is what it is. And to ignore it, I think, is a real problem. And so social media has had one kind of impact on the way that we both produce and receive and engage media and politics. Another example is the example of presidential campaigns. I worked on the 2008 Obama campaign. And that was a campaign that we are now teaching at the Kennedy School as a case study in social media and politics. That when people talk about running presidential campaigns and the use of any kind of political campaign, the use of social media in political campaigns, everyone is looking to the Obama campaign. Like the Obama campaign looked at the Dean campaign from 2004, which started the ball rolling on this, the Obama campaign took that, learned the lessons, and then took it to a whole nother level. And there was nobody during that 2008 campaign that could compete with Obama and his team of folks. And one of the things that they did early on is they hired a whole bunch of young people. One of my very recent graduates from Harvard, who was hip to Twitter and all of this stuff on social media really early, was hired by the Obama campaign. He was like 23 years old. And he became the Obama campaign's blogger. And I knew people who were working on other campaigns that election cycle who didn't even know what blogs were, really. They didn't know why they needed a campaign blogger. There was a moment in the campaign where they would send out, on any type of platform, they would ask people to make small donations, $5 donations, $10 donations, $15 donations. Some of it came over email, some of it came over Facebook, some of it came over text. And what they were able to do is they were able to generate lists of people's email addresses and their telephone numbers and their Facebook accounts, and they generated, I mean, it sounds very Big Brother, and there's probably not a coincidence between that and the NSA spying and the phone records and so forth, but that's another lecture. But the campaign was able to generate an entire database of information about millions of people in that campaign. There was a moment, I'll give you one example, there was a moment in the campaign where they said, give us your phone number. If you donate $5 and you give us your phone number, you'll be the first to know who Barack picks. And always, it's always Barack. It's never, Barack Obama, Senator Obama. It was always Barack. It was like Good Evening Friends. There was an intimacy to the way that Barack and Michelle communicate with us, right? Hillary and Bill do it too now. They did it before as well. But if you give us your phone number and donate $5, you'll be the first to know. And I remember I was in New York, and I worked in the campaign, so I knew this was happening that night. And then they sent out an email that, tonight's the night, you're going to find out tonight. And with another fundraising thing, $10, $5, right? And you're going to know. You're going to be the first to know. You 800,000 people, or 1.2 million people, you're going to be the first to know. And I was there all day, all afternoon, waiting. Everywhere in Manhattan, everyone's checking their phones. I was in Manhattan. Everywhere you went, coffee shop, the bar, walking down the street, in the park, everyone is on the phones. Look in the phone. Is it going to come yet? When is it coming? All night. No text. No nothing. What happened? Did the person pull out? Who's it going to be? People are debating the whole time. I was out with three different groups of friends from 3 o'clock in the afternoon till 3 o'clock in the morning. And at 3:07, guess what? 3:07? Joe Biden is going to be the vice president of the United States with Barack Obama. That was the moment that they chose to do that. They had people debating who it was going to be, focused on the campaign all day. And they used social media and the anticipation of getting a text on your phone from the campaign to do that. And they use all sorts of other mechanisms for that in that time. Let me end with a couple of words of concern. Things I think about that I'm actually wrestling with, and I don't have real answers for these, so I'm going to put them out there and we can have a conversation about it. I have no doubt, as someone who got email when I went to graduate school, I had a dial-up phone. I had a voicemail machine in college. I still handwrite most of the stuff that I write. I miss a lot of that old stuff. I got an email address that took me 8 years to figure out how to send an attachment, right? I was late to the iPhone. I can't do Instagram because I'm still trying to figure out Twitter, and I'm like years late doing Twitter. I'm not someone who is, this is great, this is the new world, this is the answer to all of our problems. I'm not that person. But I do believe, as I said earlier, that we have moved into a new age in terms of the relationship between media and politics, the relationship between technology and citizenship. And so I have some concerns about the fact that we are now there. There's no going back to the printing press. There's no going back to the pamphlets of the American Revolution, right? There's a place for all of that, but there's no going back to the age that has passed. One of the concerns I have about the new world that we live in is that there is a kind of echo chamber that has developed that is willful. That too many of us, and this is very true of, I would say, my generation and my students' generation, that we follow and listen to and post about and retweet the people we agree with. The people who are saying things that make us say, yeah, right on. Look how stupid those people are on the other side. And I think it breeds a kind of, not so much hyper-partisanship, but because hyper-partisanship means at least you know that there's another side to the partisan divide. I think it's breeding a kind of echo chamber where we're not even fighting with the other side anymore. We're just gloating amongst ourselves. And I'm as guilty of this as anyone. I work hard to not become that person because I feel as if I'm becoming that person. And I'm not the only one, but I implicate myself. There is so much more critique than there is encounter, to say nothing of compassion. Another concern I have is that everything personal has become political and vice versa. That the blurring of lines of distinction between what is personal and political, which is not a bad thing, right? Feminist movement, talked about the personal as the political. I believe that. I'm a gay man, right? Nobody knows the personal as the political more than a gay person who's trying to marry somebody of the same sex, right? My wedding was political, whether we liked it or not. Any black person in America walks down the street to get a thing of Skittles, to check a cell phone call, to go get flowers for his girlfriend. That act is political in America. So the personal and the political are deeply intertwined. I'm not trying to say that they're ever fully discrete or compartmentalized. But I do think that everything political has become personal, and everything personal has become political. And because you've had that experience, it therefore is fact. Or it's a collective fact. Or if someone doesn't acknowledge your experience, they've somehow discriminated against you or denigrated you in some way. Or if someone is raising up their own experience, you feel assaulted because they're in your face about something. And so I worry that the relationship between the personal and the political is that we're not thinking enough about the relationship, that the two have become one in a way that I don't think is always productive. Another concern I have is that the generational divide is real. I know that there are people in this room who are like, who cares, professor? This is ridiculous. I'm never going to tweet, right? And that's real. But I also think that there are probably some people in this room who are like, if you don't know what Twitter is, then you're problematic. I mean, I have, you know, when I look at my older colleagues who are set for retirement and my youngest students, I mean, in terms of this stuff, they are ships passing in the night. And that too produces its own, not just generational divide, but generational separation, where there's no need to think about what we can learn from folks, right? Where there's no need to think about what I would love to sit down with. I miss my grandparents. I would love to sit down with my grandparents and talk to them about Barack Obama's Twitter feed, as they tell me stories about the fireside chats. There's something beautiful about that. And one of the things, and I'll have a partisan moment here, one of the things about the Obama campaign that I will always cherish is the fact that in 2008, for the first time in my family's history, every generation in my family voted for the same person for president. And there was a reason for that. It was because Barack Obama channeled something that my grandparents could feel. There was not just this country sucks because George W. Bush sucks. It was we can be better than we are. And they recognized FDR in that. They also recognized a little bit of Reagan in that. They recognized that there could be hope and change and that no one party or one ideological position had ownership over aspiration and optimism and a better world. And so I hope that as we hurtle into the 21st century, we are not moving so far away from the 20th century that we can't recognize anyone that isn't just like us, because that's another form of narcissism. Another concern I have is that, and this is more among my students than among my elders, and I worry about my own complicity in this too, is that this generation is developing a collective ADHD. I was on a panel recently where I was on with two undergraduates who were live tweeting the panel and on Facebook while we were trying to have a conversation about something. Like, that is not the kind of world, that's not the kind of engagement. I'd rather be at home tweeting with the undergraduates who are sitting next to me than sitting next to them while they're tweeting about me and not paying any attention to me. Right, and try to teach in this environment. I tweet, I Facebook, I do all this stuff. I ban devices in my classroom. And I am reviled by certain students. There are students who won't take my classes. The Crimson's called me out as being a dinosaur in this regard. And it is what it is. But I worry a little bit that we're always on our screens and that we can't pay attention to anything for more than 140 characters. And that's worrisome too. Is I worry about the future of writing. I worry about the future, not so much of grammar, we're always gonna have technology to fix our grammar and our spelling. I worry though about the fate of investigative journalism, long form journalism, long essays, lyrical poetry, great oratory. I worry a little bit about the impact of this technological transformation on our attention span, but also on our creative imaginations. And finally, I say that my biggest concern, aside from the fact that so often what we hear becomes what we know, right? Rumor becomes fact. That's a problem, but that's always been a problem. For me, the thing that most concerns me is the worry that I have that our actual lives and relationships and loves and emotions, disagreements, are now only taking place in virtual space and time. That is the thing that I worry about the most. Because I'm not sure that we know how to be good neighbors virtually. I'm not sure that we know how to be good lovers virtually. I'm not sure that we have the capacity to be good teammates and collaborators and worthy opponents and sparring partners only virtually. That I think there's something to be said with being in a space with people, looking into their eyes, feeling when they're having a moment, not just liking something that they had a moment about several moments ago and they moved on. And so I want to make sure that as we endure and even embrace this transformation in the relationship between media and politics, as our politics change, as our media culture changes, as our role in each and our relationship to each changes, I want to make sure that we are as intentional as possible about making sure that we never let go of the actual. That we never let go of each other. Because the only way that we're ever going to build a world that is peaceful and just and accountable to itself is if we know who our neighbors are. And if we know how to or figure out how to love our neighbors as ourselves. And I'm not sure, I certainly have never encountered in my own life, a virtual relationship that has outdone the actual relationships in any of those regards. Thank you.